passing out a timeline I put together for this class. The subject I've been assigned is David through the Psalms. And as I understand the assignment, I was asked to take a look at the Psalms of David and connect them with the actual events that took place in his life in order to gain perhaps a deeper understanding of what those events signified to David. Because truly, when you look at the Psalms that David was writing as he either was going through these experiences or perhaps was reflecting back upon them, we get a real sense of the difficult times that he went through. We get a real sense of his faith in God, faith in God's fidelity to his promises. It just gives us a richer picture of what David was experiencing in his life, and I think it helps us as we go through difficult times or times of rejoicing to also help appreciate what God has provided. This morning, I'll spend some time going through the procedure I used in putting this timeline together. By no means is this timeline absolutely accurate, and I'll talk about that here in just a few minutes. It's just simply a guide for our study this morning. I'm sure if you looked at it closely enough and studied it out long enough, you'd find some errors in it because it was put together by me. And I'm just like you. I make mistakes. Don't hold this to too high of a standard. It's just simply here to give us a roadmap for today and to give us some sort of basis for our discussion. What we'll do is talk about the procedure I used to put this timeline together and then take a look, as I have outlined it here, the three periods of David's life, the events that occurred during those periods, and the Psalms that are written in reflection of those events. In my mind, it was necessary to first put together the life of David in some sort of chronological order based on what we find in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. And as you can see from the timeline, this begins with David's anointing in 1 Samuel 16 and ends with his death in 1 Kings chapter 2. I've tried to follow the order of David's life as it's recorded in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, but it's difficult to definitively ascertain whether this was actually the chronology of David's life. And let me simply give you an example. In the book of 2 Samuel, we have David building his house and then bringing the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. But in the book of 1 Chronicles, we have those two events reversed in the recording. I don't know why this was done. I'm pretty confident, though, that they were written by at least two different people, if not multiple different people. So the reason for the discrepancy, I don't think, is really that big of a deal, at least to me. When I look at 2 Chronicles, look at the very end of the book, it seems clear that it was probably put together by the same person who put together perhaps Ezra and Nehemiah. The last couple verses of 2 Chronicles are the first couple verses of Ezra, so it seems like they were put together perhaps as a unit for those who were coming back from Babylon to give them an idea of how Judah had started here and ended up here, and now they're back in the land, and gives us sort of an account of that time of restoration, if you will. So the chronology you have may not be exactly how it took place in the life of David, but to me it really doesn't make that big of a difference. I think that at least the major events, things like his anointing, obviously would be first. His thing with Bathsheba obviously occurred later on in his life. The census appears to take place later on in his life when he is in a very advanced age. But those events take place in between, perhaps, if some of them need to be turned around. I just don't think it's that big of a deal, at least to me. The next step in putting this timeline together was to go through and determine which Psalms were, in fact, written by David. And the Bible, at least our translations, assist us in this, because in 73 of the Psalms, David is directly identified as the author of that Psalm. 73 Psalms have David's name borne on them as the author. In addition, there are two Psalms, Psalm 96 and Psalm 105, that are also attributed to David. Let me go ahead and write these down for you. So we have 73 that are attributed to David as the author. Numbers 96 and 105 do not have David listed as the author, but when we go to the book of 1 Chronicles chapter 16, we see David actually expressing these psalms in celebration, I believe, of the ark being brought to the city of Jerusalem. So while he's not identified as the author in Psalms 96 and 105, when you compare it with 1 Chronicles 16, it seems pretty clear that he was the author. This gives us, at least as far as I can tell, 75 total psalms that we could be sure are David's. Now, if you look at various scholars, what you will find is the number of David's psalms is up for much debate. Some will lean toward a number in the lower 80s. Some will even undershoot this number as well. Perhaps they disregard 96 and 105. I didn't look into all the reasons. But it seems pretty clear to me, based on the Bible Testament, based on what you can open up and look at yourself, 73 written by David, 96 and 105 by the testimony of 1 Chronicles were uttered by him. So that gives us at least 75 psalms attributed to the authorship of David. Okay. Yeah, half the psalms at least were written by David. So, we've put the timeline together, we've figured out which psalms were written by David. Now it was a matter of matching up the psalms to those life events. 12 of these psalms give us biographical information. And you will see those on your timeline in bold, matched up with these events. If you look down here at the bottom, you'll see these numbers, these psalms in bold down here along the bottom. And these are the corresponding psalms to the life events. Now you also notice over here, Psalms 96 and 105 I put in italics because 1 Chronicles tells us that David wrote them, but the book of Psalms does not. So it seems clear that he did, but I wasn't going to put those in bold. You also see one additional number over here, Psalm 4, that's underlined over here in the late period of his life. That psalm seems to go along with Psalm 3, but David's not attributed as the author, but it does seem to be sort of a bookend, if you will, to Psalm 3. And if we have time, we'll get to that. So 12 psalms are very clearly labeled as David as the author. And a good example of that is in Psalm 52 and 1. Psalm 52 and 1 opens up like this. To the chief musician, a contemplation of David when Doeg the Edomite went and told Saul and said to him, David has gone to the house of Ahimelech. So there we have David attributed as the author, and we have a specific event identified as the inspiration for this psalm. Pretty clearly laid out. So in the case of these 12, it's very easy to figure out what events they line up with. Which leaves us some question marks and at least 61 others. Where do they belong? I've talked about 96-105. And you'll also notice on your timeline, down here, there's a bracket. And I've put Psalms addressed to the chief musician that lack biographical information. Let me explain what I mean by that. The ark is brought to the tabernacle in Jerusalem in 1 Chronicles chapter 16, verses 4 and 5. And when it's brought to the Davidic tabernacle, David appoints Levites to be musicians to worship before the Lord. In 1 Chronicles chapter 25, verses 1 through 7, we see David appointing three men as the chief musicians for the tabernacle. Asaph, Jeduthun, and Heman. 1 Chronicles 25, 1 through 7. I classify these 28 psalms in this time period since it follows the establishment of the chief musician, but it contains no other biographical information. I will say this as a disclaimer, however. This is not 100% reliable. Earlier I cited Psalm 52 and 1 that is addressed to the chief musician, but it appears that it was written perhaps far before this actual event of establishing the chief musician took place. because it talks about an event that took place well before this happened. So it's not 100% reliable. So the Psalms that I've listed here, 5, 6, 8, 9, 11, 12, 13, 14, 19, are addressed to the chief musician, but whether or not they were actually written in this time period is difficult, if not impossible, to ascertain. I simply put them there to bring your attention to the fact that worship under the old law changed when they brought the ark to the tabernacle. Chief musicians were established. There was worship that took place there on a regular basis. What happened to the tabernacle before that, we're not sure. We don't have any information regarding that. Okay. Finally, you'll see down here in this box that's entitled Psalms Lacking an Inscription, Address, or Recorded Event. What I mean by that is this. David is identified as the author, but there's no biographical link, and there's no one to whom it's addressed. It just says a Psalm of David, or a Song of David. That's all we have. So I put those in a separate category by themselves and listed them out. You also see I put 96 and 105 in italics in here, just simply because it seems pretty clear that David's the author, but we can't be totally sure. Alright. Are there any questions, comments about how I put this timeline together? Does it make sense so far? Is everybody following my procedure thus far? I didn't want to just throw this timeline down in front of you and expect you to put the pieces together yourself. This is sort of the process that I went through in researching all this. Any questions? Anybody confused so far? Alright. You'll notice on your timeline, and just in case you're like me and you like to put together timelines, I will tell you that this timeline itself is just a table in Microsoft Word. What you do is you just make a table. So you got your table. Okay. Just get rid of your top border there. You got two rows, you got a timeline. It's pretty easy. So if you ever want to put together one in your own study, that's the way you do it. That's all I've done. In that middle part of the table, I've divided David's life up into three periods. His early period, as you can see, runs from his anointing through the death of Saul. So everything that happened to David before he was a king. The middle period I date from the beginning of his reign through his end with Bathsheba. The final or late period I date from Nathan's rebuke through the end of his life. And notice I do make a distinction between the two because they did happen at two different times. His sin with Bathsheba occurred, the baby was born, and then Nathan came and rebuked him later on. And really Nathan's rebuke began a very different chapter in David's life. Everything before this had been quite good. Everything that followed was extremely challenging for him. I've only put these into three periods just simply for an outlining purpose. They're just my own application just to keep things organized in my mind so it's clear to you what we're talking about and where these events fall in David's life. All right. Anything that is confusing to you? And just in case you wanted to know, there's the early, middle, and late and how I reckon those. Okay. Finally, in a study like this, as you can already tell, this could turn into a very academic and scholarly exercise very quickly. And I can tell, after being here for 2 days, and starting out with a very scholarly and academic exercise, I may lose you in about 10 or 15 minutes. I don't want that to turn into this. My only reason for going through the procedures was for you to understand how I arrived at these conclusions. But I do not want to treat the remainder of this class in the same regard, in the same way. Connecting David's life events with the Psalms he wrote is an academic exercise. But when we begin to analyze the Psalms themselves, when we begin to look at what they say, we need to leave the realm of analysis and remember that we're reading the expressions of a man's soul. These Psalms offer a window into David. His innermost thoughts and feelings concerning these events are laid bare to us. And unless we develop some sort of personal connection between the author's thoughts and ourselves, I'm afraid we might not fully appreciate the depth of expressed emotion here. We've got to connect ourselves with what David is writing. Understand what's taking place in his life. Figure out how we might feel as a result of those events that they were taking place with us. And then connect ourselves with the Psalms that he's writing. So while all this to now has been fairly academic, I don't want the remainder of it to be academic. So, to keep ourselves from making this just a purely analytical class, very, how shall we say, antiseptic maybe? Is that the right word I'm looking for? That wouldn't be the right word. Is that the right word? Well, it's a word I can't think of. That's just typical with me. Very dry, very boring. I want to adopt the following approach, if you will. As we go through these life events, what I want to do is begin by establishing the context in which this was written. So look at the actual passages in 1 Samuel or 1 Chronicles or 2 Samuel for that matter. Once we've established that context, I want to take a moment to reflect on how you might feel if you were in David's shoes. And I'm going to open that up to you. I want you to place yourselves in the sandals of David and figure out, how would I feel if I was going through this? Can I identify with what David is feeling and what he's going through? And then after we've done that, we'll read this psalm in its entirety and I'll make a few comments about how it connects with the event itself, and I'll ask you for your own input as well. My whole approach is to help us develop a deeper connection between ourselves and what David was feeling. I think the Psalms are a wonderful opportunity for us to do that. They're emotional. They're the expression of a man's innermost feelings. So let's take an opportunity to open ourselves up and think how we might feel or how perhaps we have felt when going through similar situations. Any questions, comments, things that you'd like to add to what we've looked at so far? I hope this approach makes sense to you. You can see how I put all this together. Anything? All right. We're going to begin in 1 Samuel chapter 19, which in a moment we will cross-reference with Psalm 59. That is the first Psalm linked with the biographical event that you have on your timeline in the early period of David's life. Let's begin by establishing some context. David is anointed in what chapter of 1 Samuel? 16. He kills Goliath in which chapter? 17. And what happens in chapter 18? Well, in chapter 18, David begins falling out of favor with Saul. Saul begins developing some jealousy over the people's response to David because the people are placing David on a higher pedestal than they were the king. You remember what's said about David and Saul, don't you? What does it say about David and Saul there? Exactly right. Saul heard this and you can imagine the relationship that existed between the two of them began to deteriorate quite fast. Jonathan, in chapter 18, has intervened on David's behalf. And Saul has relented momentarily. That might actually be in chapter 19. That's actually in chapter 19, excuse me. Yet we see David defeating the Philistines once again. And once he defeats the Philistines, that distressing spirit returns, and Saul makes another attempt on David's life. So what we have here is just a pure case of jealousy. David escapes, but you'll remember, when David escapes, Saul's in David's house, and they're going to ambush him and murder him. Anybody remember? That's right. Michael helps him escape. David flees to Samuel at Ramah and sends the Ephraimites. Accumulating all these victories, all these significant events are happening to him, and yet we have this king on his doorstep surrounding his house on his behalf. All these things are taking place. The question is this: how would you feel if you were placed in David's circumstances, think about that for a moment. How would you feel? Whenever you have a thought, just go ahead and raise your hand or speak out. Okay. What else? How else might you feel if you were in David's sandals? Okay. Be real temptation, wouldn't it? Real temptation. Okay. Other words. Here's one that came to my mind. Indignation. I've done nothing wrong. I've done nothing wrong, yet why? Why is Saul trying to kill me? Might also feel a sense of betrayal. It's his own father-in-law trying to kill him, right? His own father-in-law is trying to kill him. Betrayal. Disillusion. Bewildered, perhaps. How can I be delivered from the hands of the king with all of his vast resources and manpower? How can I get away from him? He's got all these men who can pursue me. How can I escape? When you go ahead, Tom.
I think that he would have respected Saul.
Yeah.
His king, his father-in-law. I don't know if there was anything before this he would have here in his cause.
Back in chapter 18, verse 14, twice. Yeah. But yeah, but you're right, before this, what reason would he? What reason would Saul have had to kill him? Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add? Okay, let's keep these things in mind. Now let's turn to Psalm 59. And let's just take a moment to read Psalm 59. See if we can gain a greater insight into David's soul, if you will, his thoughts. John Morris, would you mind reading Psalm 59 for us, please? Thank you, John. I think you can see the connection pretty clearly, can't you? Notice at the very beginning of this psalm, John did not read it, but this is typical with these 12 psalms. We have an inscription here. Said to do not destroy a miktam of David when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. So very clearly this psalm is linked up with the very events that we just discussed back in 1 Samuel chapter 19. Let's take a look at just a few things that are said in the psalm that link it up in addition to this. Go ahead, Tom.
The mark of 11 line says, like you said, do not destroy a golden psalm.
No, there's not a lot of clarity on some of these terms, like miktam and some of these things that are not. I mean, mine says a miktam. I guess a golden psalm might mean the same thing. I don't know. It means golden? Okay. Thank you, Rick. I think I've got it somewhere. I'll have to dig it out after the class. Yeah, there's several of them around. Mm-hmm. Okay. Verse 3, for look, they lie in wait for my life. Connects up pretty clearly, doesn't it? You've got men standing outside your house waiting for you to come out. They're lying in wait for your life. Verse 3, the mighty gather against me. Who's really behind all this? King Saul, right? The mighty are gathering against David. Verses 3 and 4, not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord. They run and prepare themselves through no fault of mine. Awake to help me, and behold. David has not done anything to instigate this. Anything sinful, I guess I should say. This is all Saul's jealousy. David recognizes the fact that he has no fault in this circumstance. Now later on, when we read Psalm 3 and we talk about Absalom, David never says that he lacks sin or lacks iniquity. But here, it's clear, he recognizes the fact he's done nothing to earn this situation. Twice in this, he talks about dogs going around the city. I like verses 14 and 15. And at evening they return, they growl like a dog and go all around the city. They wander up and down for food and howl if they are not satisfied. I think of ravenous dogs just stalking him. That's, I think, what he's likening the people who are standing outside his home to, waiting for him to come out, waiting to take their prey, to kill him. Yet notice that David does not lose his faith amidst all of this. We talked about him potentially being fearful, angry. Yet notice in verses 16 and 17, I will sing of your power. To you, O my strength, I will sing praises, for God is my defense, my God of mercy. Other things that you see in this psalm, other thoughts really strike you. Clint, go right ahead. Ah, beautiful. Thank you. Good observation, Clint. Other thoughts, Tom?
I noticed also verse 11, very clear. Do not kill. It reminds me of other enemies that God did not kill his enemies.
And isn't this typical of David when we consider the fact that he spared Saul's life twice, two occasions where he could kill him? And remember what he did to the man who killed Saul, the one who claimed he killed Saul. Put him to death. Remember what he did to the one who claimed that he killed, or the ones who killed Ish-bosheth, Saul's son. They come to him, they brag about it, puts him to death. So I think that this is a common theme in the life of David. Yes, go ahead, Thomas. That's right. Very good. Good. Other observations or thoughts? Things that you see?
Very good. Long. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Other thoughts? Go ahead, Tom. Anything else? Go ahead, Kevin. Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you for looking that up. I have the sheet in my... Yeah, that's okay. I've got the sheet over there in my bag. I just didn't want to take the time to go look for it. So, thank you. Anything else to offer? Uh, 60 is David's. Mm-hmm. Sure is. Yeah, you scared me there for a second, Mike, because we're going to talk about 60. And I thought, oh no, what have I done? 60, 60. Yeah, yep. At least that's what it says in my introduction. Mm-hmm. Okay. Started sweating there. Woo! Now you'll see me get nervous. Yeah, John, go ahead. I did not do any looking into that. I do know that the American Standard Version does not carry these inscriptions with it, but every other major version carries them. So, yeah, they may not be inspired. Okay. Sure. Thank you for that. Oh, one other additional thing. These inscriptions are contained in the Septuagint as well, so I don't know if that helps out at all. But at least we're getting a little bit farther back, closer to the actual events themselves. So whether... Yeah. Yeah, then whether or not they inspire, yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything else? If not, let's... We're going to skip on your timeline, Psalm 34, which surrounds David fleeing from Gath in 1 Samuel 21. We're going to skip that one and go instead to 1 Samuel chapter 22. Let's go ahead and turn back there for a moment. Got anything else? So we've skipped 1 Samuel 21 and Psalm 34. We're going to 1 Samuel 22. And momentarily, we'll look at Psalm 52 in relation to this. At the end of chapter 21, David has feigned madness and fled from Gath. And he's found sanctuary in the cave of Adullam, the beginning of chapter 22. At the beginning of chapter 22, he also arranges for his parents' safekeeping with the king of Moab. So he recognizes the fact that there could be a threat to his parents' life and arranges safekeeping for them during this time. Saul is now in full pursuit of David. This is David on the run. Back in chapter 21, you'll recall that Ahimelech assisted David and his men by allowing them to eat the showbread and also passing Goliath's sword on to David. Saul in chapter 22 finds out about Ahimelech's earlier assistance through Doeg the Edomite. And Saul has Doeg kill all the priests along with all the inhabitants of Nob, the city of the priests. Abiathar, at the end of chapter 22, escapes and goes to David and informs him of what took place. Informs him of the massacre, in essence. So these are the events that are taking place. Let's follow our established route. If you were in David's shoes, how might you feel at this moment? Perhaps the feelings might be the same. They may have changed. What do you think? I think verse 22 in this 22nd chapter gives us perhaps a little insight into how David was feeling and how we would probably feel. I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. So David feels responsible for the deaths of these people. He recognizes that he put them into danger and he feels a sense of guilt for their death. There's one aspect. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The king of Israel has put to death priests of the Most High God. That's what's just taking place. Okay. Other things. Anything else? We're going to talk about 52, but we can look at 57 if you want. 52 we'll look at in particular. So. Did you have something for 57 you wanted to bring up?
Well, I liked the idea that down in verse 7 and 8 and 9, he's reacting right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he reminds me of Job. I mean, he feared the loss of his possessions and his children. He worshiped them. Whenever something terrible happens, part of the design of the enemy is to keep praise. So to be able to praise God in the midst of it.
Anything else? Well, let's go ahead and turn to 52 for a moment. And Clint Sparks, would you read Psalm 52 for us, please? Thank you. The inscription in the beginning of 52 does point to this event. Doeg the Edomite went and told Saul and said to him, David has gone to the house of Ahimelech. And that's what leads Saul to Ahimelech and then the massacre of the priests and the city of Nob. When Doeg informed Saul of David's encounter with Ahimelech, he accuses the priest of consulting God on behalf of David. He said David asked the priest to consult God for him. Now, when we look in the original account back in chapter 21, is that actually what took place? Do they recall? We might just go ahead and take a look, turn back there for just a moment. Keep your finger here. But in chapter 21, so far as I can tell, David never asked Ahimelech to consult God on his behalf. David simply asked him for food, and he asked him if he has any weapons. Ahimelech gives him food, he gives him weapons, but later on in chapter 22, verses 9 and 10, this is what Doeg the Edomite says. I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. So there is a little bit of deception going on here. The provisions and the sword did actually take place, but this idea of David asking Ahimelech to consult God on his behalf is not recorded in chapter 21. Which makes me wonder if that is why David wrote what he did in the first three verses of Psalm 52. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The goodness of God endures continually. Your tongue devises destruction, like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love evil more than good, lying rather than speaking righteousness. It makes me wonder if he's not pointing directly at Doeg. You're deceiving in order to have me convicted before Saul. It could be that David inquiring of the Lord was not carried in the 21st chapter. Maybe it happened, but it seems to me that there was probably some deceit at work. Although I don't think it would have been necessary. Them just simply providing provisions and a sword would probably have been enough. So it makes me wonder if that's not what David's addressing here in these first three verses. Was Doeg deceiving Saul when he brought up this first piece of evidence? I think so. I'm not going to say so definitively. Other thoughts that you have about that? I don't know if anybody else has noticed that before. Feel free to disagree. I didn't take a look at that tangent. No, I don't know. Does anybody else have any knowledge about that? The question was about swords. How available were they? Apparently they weren't very available, otherwise David seemingly would have one at this time. I don't know. I just don't know. Anything? Could be. Could very well be. In Psalm 52, we see a common theme that's expressed in a lot of the Psalms. The judgment of the wicked. And I think it's interesting how this is contrasted with something that David says later on. Look in verse 5. God shall likewise destroy you forever. He shall take you away and pluck you out of your dwelling place. And notice the word here. And uproot you from the land of the living. Uproot means, you know, pull the plant out of the ground, right? But then notice how he describes himself in verse 8. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. In other words, he's planted in a safe and secure place, whereas God is going to uproot the evil and the wicked. So there's a contrast there. It's drawn between the wicked and the righteous. In verse 7 makes us wonder if Doeg was in fact a rich man. Here's the man who did not make God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches. He could be talking about Doeg. He also could be talking about Saul. Either one. And then this psalm closes with David's expression of faithfulness and the fidelity of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise you forever because you've done it. And in the presence of your saints, I will wait on your name, for it is good. So, David, as Tom rightly points out, still has the good attitude, even amidst all this. He recognizes where his strength and his faith should be placed. Anything else about... Yeah, go ahead, John. Thank you. That's a good point. Anything else you'd like to add? I thought we might take the time to read Psalm 57, but time is escaping us very quickly. So I skipped something in my PowerPoint here. Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, go ahead, Dan. Yeah. Thank you. Waiting on the Lord. Anything else? All right, we're going to do a little skipping here. Let's skip over to 2 Samuel chapter 5 and look at verses 11 through 16. I hope I've got the right slide material here. Yeah. And we'll cross-reference that with Psalm 30 here in just a moment. I think we're all familiar with the material in between. You'll remember at the beginning of 2 Samuel that David learns of Saul's death. He mourns the loss of both him and Jonathan and teaches Judah the song of the bow. You'll recall that Judah anoints David as king and that Abner anoints Ishbosheth as king over the remainder of Israel. And we see civil war breaking out between the houses of David and Saul in the preceding chapters. We see Abner's influence over the house of Saul growing steadily. He eventually turns on Ishbosheth and makes peace with David, but is murdered by Joab and Abishai. Ishbosheth is eventually assassinated. His murderers are executed by David. David is finally anointed king over the entire nation of Israel. He conquers the Jebusite city of Jerusalem at the beginning of chapter 5. And establishes the stronghold of Zion as his capital. And with Jerusalem established as his capital, David receives materials, carpenters, masons, from Hiram, king of Tyre, to build a house. And I want to bring your attention to one verse in this fifth chapter of 2 Samuel, and this may be the key verse of the chapter. So David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people. That to me is a momentous statement. Here's a man who was anointed king back in 1 Samuel 16, who has gone through all these experiences, and once Saul is dead, his troubles are not over. He has a divided kingdom. There's civil war going on between these two parties that are warring for control over the nation of Israel. And with the building of his house, he recognizes that God's promise, God's anointing has been fulfilled, that he is set as king. He's established after going through all these terrible things. So think of all the critical moments that led up to this moment. Think of all the things that happened to David. And for a moment, think how you might feel. Think how you might feel.
That feeling you get when you finish your last final for the semester, and it's over, done, home free, that kind of that feeling of relief, joy.
Okay. I understand that feeling completely. That would be on a very micro level compared to this, wouldn't it? Yeah. Go ahead, Jeff. Yeah. Okay. Other thoughts? Let's read Psalm 30, because I think when I put all this into context and then I read Psalm 30, I think that Psalm 30 brings us all together very nicely. Psalm 30. Let's see. Richard, would you mind reading Psalm 30 for us, please?
I will tell you, O Lord, for you have lifted me up, and have not let my foes rejoice over me. O Lord my God, I cried out to you, and you healed me. O Lord, you brought my soul up from the grave. You have kept me alive that I should not go down to the grave. Sing praise to the Lord, you saints of his, and give thanks at remembrance of his holy name. For his anger is but for a moment, his favor is for life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And gave you a face and I was troubled. I cried out to you, O Lord, and to the Lord I made my supplication. What profit is there in my blood when I go down to the pit? Will thus praise you? Will it declare your truth? Hear, O Lord, and have mercy on me, Lord, be my helper. You have turned me for my mourning into dancing. You have put off my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness. To the end that my glory may sing praise to you and not be silent, O Lord, my God, I will be thankful to you forever.
Wonderful, isn't it? The first five verses to me are especially moving when you put it in context with what had taken place. How close had David come to death before this? He's been brought up from the grave. Brought my soul up from the grave. You've kept me alive that I should not go down to the pit. I like verse 5. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. David's just been through a very long night, has he not? And now he's rejoicing in a morning, if you will. The light has shone forth. The day has come. He's realized the promises of God. They've been fulfilled, and he is rejoicing. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And notice what he says in verse 6. Now in my prosperity I said, I shall never be moved. He's been through all this. He's now the king of Israel. He has vast resources at his disposal. He has not forgotten what God has done for him. I shall never be moved. He's affirming his faithfulness to God once again. He recognizes the blessings of God. Lord, by your favor, you have made my mountain stand strong. Yet he does not forget those difficult moments of trouble. You hid your face and I was troubled. I cried out to you, O Lord, and to the Lord I made supplication. What profit is there in my blood? And he goes on. He remembers those times of despair, of difficulty. And yet he recognizes that the Lord heard his prayer and he brought David to this moment. Verses 11 and 12. You've turned from me my mourning into dancing. You have put off my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness. The Lord has brought him through all this. And now he is rejoicing. I think this is just a beautiful psalm when you put it into context, if in fact the inscription is correct. Very lovely to me. Other thoughts that you have about Psalm 30, things that you see in the psalm. Other thoughts? Yeah, I do too. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Seems like I have it. Very good. Anything else? Okay, anything else? Thank you. Good contrast. Anything else? All right. We're going to skip 2 Samuel 6, which we could cross-reference with Psalm 96 and 105. That has to do with the ark being brought to Jerusalem. And instead, I'd like to skip to 2 Samuel chapter 8, and we'll consider Psalm 60 in conjunction with that in just a moment. 2 Samuel 8. Now, I've put a map up here on the PowerPoint just simply for you to appreciate David's victories throughout his reign. The unshaded area right in here represents the original kingdom, as I understand it. During David, you can see the expansion that took place, and then this area up here with the dots apparently represents what Solomon was able to secure as well. So this is what David, through the wars, managed to secure for Israel. And you'll remember that
the territory that was promised to Abraham extended from where to where? Does anybody remember? The Nile to the Euphrates, essentially. And that's nearly realized in the reign of Solomon. I think that's up to the Euphrates, if memory serves me correct. I don't know if they made it down to the Nile or not. Alright. So what's happened between chapter 5, which we looked at, and this 8th chapter? Well, after he builds his poem, David drives the Philistines back from Geba, and with that victory, he decides to bring the Ark into Jerusalem. You remember in transit that Uzzah steadies the Ark while it's unlawfully transported. Let's not forget that. It was supposed to be carried on poles, correct? But it was being transported on an oxen cart. Uzzah reached down to steady it and dies as a result. And you remember the Ark took a pit stop for a moment of time at the house of Obed-Edom. Then it comes to Jerusalem, and it's Psalm 96 and 105 that appear to be uttered at that time. With the Ark in Jerusalem, David then expresses his desire to build a house for God. Jehovah makes a covenant with him in chapter 7 concerning the building of the temple and also promises that the kingly lineage will descend from him. And we see there a shadow also of the messianic promise that would be fulfilled with Jesus Christ. And in chapter 8, we see several of David's military victories. Victories over the Philistines, the Moabites, the Zobahites, and the Syrians explained for us. I just want to take a moment to read this account. Not all of it, but just a good cross-section. Let's see. Dan Turner, would you read verses 1 through 8 of 2 Samuel 8 for us? I tell you that John Lee put me up to that, but that wouldn't be right. Thank you. I'm sorry you had to labor through that. The only impression I want you to get from those eight verses, notice, you've got a lot of battles taking place, but what do you know about those battles? Very little, right? Basically that these nations were defeated and tribute was given, territory was secured, but there's real no description of what took place in the battles. All right? Keep that in mind because that's important. Before we turn over to Psalm 60, let's not forget, you've got all these things taking place. The house has been built in Jerusalem. The covenant's been secured in chapter 7 concerning the temple and the kingly lineage. He's got all these victories happening in chapter 8. David's got things going pretty well right now, doesn't he? Seems like things are going pretty easily. How would you feel? Feel pretty confident right now, right? Just based on what you read, that's what seems to be happening. Now let's go read Psalm 60 for a moment. Psalm 60. Graydon, Petro, would you mind reading that for us, please?
Oh God, your
Thank you. A little different spin than what we get in 2 Samuel 8, isn't it? If the inscription is accurate, and this does in fact describe the time of what is taking place in 2 Samuel 8, you get a very different impression. We see these defeats and these territories being taken, this gold being secured. But that only gives us a very small inkling of what actually is taking place. When you read the first 3 verses, what sense do you get about these battles? Yeah. Yes. These were not easy things. It seems like they were just going on and marching and everything was fine, but that was perhaps not the case. These were hard-fought affairs in which Israel experienced difficulties that the historical record does not contain, if Psalm 60 is in fact linked up with this biographical event. It seems, to me at least, that perhaps this psalm was written in the midst of all these things taking place. I think that, simply because all these terrible things are happening, they remember in verses 6 through 8 what God has promised, and then they come to the conclusion in verses 9 through 12 that God is going to give us the victory. So I wonder if these things aren't taking place right in the midst of, the writing of this is not taking place in the midst of all these battles. Things aren't going well, but they remember what God has promised, and they know that He will deliver. That what He has promised, He is also able to perform. I like verses 4 and 5. You have given a banner to those who fear you, that it may be displayed because of truth, that your beloved may be delivered. Save with your right hand and hear me. God did not appoint this nation to be forsaken. He did not appoint this nation just to go into obscurity. He appointed this nation to demonstrate truth, to demonstrate that He was the one who was going to deliver them. David remembers this and calls out to God, save with your right hand and hear me. So, even amidst these times of despair, when it appears that God's not with them, that things are going awry, David remembers God's promises that He will not forsake them. Verses 6 through 8 seem to be a little curious. These promises of God. What do you suppose these promises of God concern? What's this all about? Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
The one promise I'm thinking of is that this is the performance of the promise of God.
Okay, very good.
The elders are serving in the This will be the first one.
Okay, very good. Yeah, Edom is brought under the control of Israel at this point. All right, good. What else? Well, when you read, I will divide Shechem, the valley of Succoth, Gilead, Manasseh, Ephraim, Judah. All those were geographical locations within Canaan, right? This was the land that God had given His people, right? And in addition, verse 8, Moab, Edom, Philistia. Remember God's original promise to Abraham, from the Nile to the Euphrates. River of Egypt. Yes, thank you, Rick. Yeah. Which you would understand that to be... Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you for correcting that. Right about there. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you get that. I got that word stuck in my head for some reason. Thank you for correcting that. I appreciate that very much. Okay, good. So essentially what we see is the beginning of this fulfillment, right? Beginning of this fulfillment. You got Moab and Edom down here. Manasseh, didn't they have a portion over here on this side of the Jordan River? Memory serves me correct. We've got the borders being pushed back and being extended. So even in this moment of despair, David is remembering what God has promised. That Israel is to take this territory. That it's supposed to be theirs. And because of those promises, then he has the confidence in verses 9 through 12 to say, God is going to give us victory. He's promised this. He's going to give us victory. When I first looked at verses 6 through 8, I was really, I wondered what that was talking about. But that, to me, that seems to be the best explanation. Other thoughts you have about that? John? Yeah, Syria would be up in here. Damascus. Moabites and Edomites are brought under control later on in chapter 8. So, yeah. Philistines in the west, yeah. Yep. Very good. Any other thoughts? Well, we've got about 10 minutes. We did skip one back in David's early life, but let's go ahead and look at one in his later life. We don't have enough time to really set the stage. You all know the story of Absalom, so I don't know that it's necessary for us to go back over that. I'd like to turn to Psalm 3 for a moment. And I want you to notice the difference between what David was writing when he was fleeing from Saul and what David was writing when he was fleeing from his son Absalom. Now remember, Absalom's rebellion was the result of what event? What was that tied back to? Yeah. The sword would not depart from the house of David, right? That there would be strife within his house. Absalom was a manifestation of that, was it not? So David, unlike earlier in his life, cannot claim that he is free from guilt. He realizes that his sin is in part responsible for creating the circumstances that he is now under. So what we see being expressed in the Psalms written around the time of Saul, I'm free from iniquity, I'm free from sin, why are these people doing these things to me? Because I'm righteous. He can't express here. There's a whole different tenor to this. Let's read Psalm 3. And let's see, Grant, would you mind reading Psalm 3 for us? Puts it in real perspective, doesn't it? This is a time of real despair for him. Totally unlike what he had written earlier. Now, if you go to a commentary and you look at the Psalms that I've not lined up with any biographical event, what you're going to find is a lot of the Psalms that are in this box in particular, a lot of the commentators are going to align with two periods of David's life, either Absalom or Saul. Because a lot of them contain some expressions of despair and trouble and difficult times. I did not do that. The only one that I felt comfortable putting definitively down as connected with this event was Psalm 3. But if you do look at commentators, some say that this has to do with Absalom. Some say this has to do with Saul. So I leave that to your own discretion. I was only comfortable with going with the inscriptions, because that seems to be the most reasonable route. So let's take a moment, and as we reflect back on the incidents with Absalom, what David's going through, what connections do you see between Psalm 3 and what he's experiencing in his life? What are some thoughts that really stick out to you? That's right. Absalom had curried the favor of much of the nation, had he not? They liked Absalom a lot. Yeah, stole their hearts. Thank you. Yep.
I lie down and sleep, awake again because the Lord sustains me. But all through seven burdens in the community. Bless the people. The Lord delivered me every morning. The morning I rise again to deal with. I don't know if that, I will not be able to use the house. I don't know if that's the main thing, but part of my mind is to stay with the inside.
Yeah, that's a nice observation there. There was a time when David was known for filling his 10,000s, and now he recognizes he's surrounded by 10,000s. Very good. Yeah, it's almost when he lays down in sleep, he's not even sure he's going to wake up the next morning. Because the mercy that he's shown others, Saul in particular, is not, he doesn't feel as assured for himself. John, go ahead. Thank you. Excellent. Anything else? Yes, go ahead. For sure.
Verse 3 or verse 2, there is no help from any God. I thought possibly there's King Asher from David, and King Asher from the whole thing. And in verse 8, he attributes Absalom's rise to the war.
Anything else? Very good. All right. Well, let's back up. I've got one other section I wanted to take a look at earlier in the life of David that I didn't have on my PowerPoint. It really doesn't mean anything. Didn't get to it. I will say this. I had in that late period, 2 Samuel 12, which is cross-referenced with Psalm 51. Most of you are very familiar with Psalm 51, so I decided not to take any time to look at that. Most of you looked at that on your own. Chapters 13 through 18 of 2 Samuel, I link up with Psalm 3 and 4. And I guess I should say something about Psalm 4. When you compare Psalms 3 and 4, there does seem to be some real parallels here. For instance, in Psalm 4, verses 4 and 5, be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. Remember what he said, we alluded to this, about David as he went to bed, wondered if he would be even waking up the next morning. And in Psalm 4, we see perhaps the way he got through those nights. How did he get through those nights? He was meditating on the Lord. The Lord was getting him through those times. He was waking up. Verse 8, I will both lie down in peace and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. David is relying right now on the protection of God. At even his most vulnerable times, he realizes that there's no one who can protect him but God. So it seems like maybe Psalm 4 goes along with Psalm 3. I'm not overly dogmatic about that. I simply bring it to your attention. You can decide that for yourself. So let's go over to Psalm 63. We'll close with this one. Psalm 63. If the inscriptions are trustworthy, Psalms 54, 63, and 142. Make sure I got those numbers correct. Yeah. All have to do with what's taking place in First Samuel, chapters 23 through 26, which is essentially David on the run, hiding from Saul in the caves and the strongholds of En-Gedi, in the wilderness of Judah. And these seem to concern that time as he's fleeing from the wrath of Saul. Let's just take a moment and read Psalm 63. And Brandon Lee, would you mind reading that for us, please? All right. Notice the inscription in this, that this was written while he was in the wilderness of Judah. He's hiding in the wilderness, and when you read verse 1, it seems very appropriate how he words this. My soul thirsts for you, my flesh longs for you, in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. That wouldn't be entirely true of this region. There were rivers and sources of water in this region, so that's not entirely true, but yet when you picture being in a wilderness, being in a desolate place, being alone, the imagery that he brings up in verse 1 just makes me think that that's connected with what he was going through in this time. Once again, in verses 3 through 5, though he's in these difficult circumstances, though he is seeking for help, David's solution is found in God. And notice how he handles the situation in verse 6. And we talked about this back in Psalm 4. When I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. What was it that sustained him through those times of vulnerability, through the times at night when he wasn't sure he was going to wake up? Well, it was him meditating on his bed, thinking about God, finding consolation and comfort in the knowledge that God had anointed him to become king, and God's promise David was sure would be fulfilled. In verse 7, we have a phrase that appears, I believe, 4 times in the book of Psalms. In the shadow of your wings, I will rejoice. Now, what sort of imagery does that bring up in your mind? Excuse me? Very good, yeah. Then gathering your chicks under her wings. Protection of God. Under his wings, he found comfort, consolation, and protection. And it's his right hand that upholds David. Right hand, the hand of power, the hand of blessing. That's what's upholding David during this time. The right hand of God. He's got the protection, he's being upheld by God, and he is confident, verses 9 and 10, that judgment will come upon the wicked. This is a very common theme, is it not, through these Psalms? Those who seek my life to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. So David is confident that though things seem to be bad, he's going to come through this time by the power of God. Anything else you see in this Psalm that you can relate to what we see in 2 Samuel or any other thoughts you might have? Very good. Yeah, at the beginning of verse 7, because you have been my help. So he recognizes the fact that God's been there for him before, that God's going to get him through this time. He has that, I guess, that foundation to build upon. He recognizes that God's been with him in the past, that he is not going to forsake him or abandon him. Good. Other thoughts? Anybody? Well, I guess I won't take you up to 1:30. That's all the material I've prepared for today. So we did start about 5 minutes early, so we'll end about 5 minutes early, if that's okay.
Any other concluding questions or comments? This study was very helpful for me. I hope it's been a good exercise for you, and I think it's just interesting to get a different perspective. You read the historical accounts, but then when you take the Psalms themselves and you begin to see what's going on in David's mind and his heart, you develop a real appreciation for the man and for his faithfulness in God, and someone that we can admire for the good things that he did on behalf of God and for his name. So, anything else you all want to add? Well, let's conclude there then. Thank you.